It is not every presidential inauguration that features a poet, but when there is a poet at an inauguration, that person seems to be a discussion topic for quite a while afterward. This hour's guest had the rare honor of reading a poem at the second inauguration of President Obama last year. Richard Blanco is of Cuban-American descent, but born in Spain, and he brought a lot of firsts with him to the podium last year in Washington. He visits us in, he visits Ashland this evening to speak, brought to Ashland High School by the Chautauqua Poets and Writers, and he's our guest here now. Richard Blanco, good to see you.
Good morning, Jeffrey. How are you?
Good. It seems like you're very difficult to categorize. We could call you Cuban-American, but that glosses over the fact that you're born in Spain. You're a poet and a teacher, but that skips your degree in civil engineering.
Right.
But you did read the poet. So let's talk about the basic bio stuff. When people say, where are you from? What's the answer?
Well, I've had this sort of short saying that I can't seem to shake from my first book in my bio, and I say, made in Cuba, assembled in Spain, and imported to the United States, which kind of wraps it up. I think my mom left 7 months pregnant from Cuba, and then we went to Spain. I was born. And 45 days later, we came to the United States. So my newborn photo is my green card photo. So if that wasn't sort of the sign of a higher power sort of saying, guess what you're going to be obsessed about in your life and in your writing, this idea of home and place and where do I belong. So I've kind of – that's the way I describe it. But you're right to say that, you know, it seems in my life is always sort of living somewhere between two hyphens or between two sort of opposites or squeezed between two different things, poet, engineer, Cuban-American. Mm-hmm. So that's definitely, I feel like, a theme or a thread in my life.
It seems like it wouldn't be the same life without it, though, without the hyphens.
Certainly not, yeah.
So let's talk about the poetry first. How old were you when you first even considered writing poetry, and did you write other things first?
Well, you know, I'm not one of those poets that claims to have been writing in the womb. I actually came to poetry quite late in life, and it was actually through engineering, and oddly enough, because when I first started working as an engineer in a consulting office, I didn't realize how much writing there was involved. I started writing reports and studies and letters and all this. And I finally sort of really started paying really close attention to language and falling in love with language and its texture and the whole idea that it's an alive thing that you work with to sort of get a desired result. And I started excelling in my job because of the writing. I mean, the guy that gets the job is the guy that writes the good proposal. And then I should say I've always had a left brain, right brain. That's another thing that's going on.
So another hyphen.
Right. But since we were a working class, you know, struggling immigrant family, you know, the idea of a life in the arts really was outside of the realm of possibility. But I always felt that there was something creative that I wanted to do as well in my life. And then when this happened with engineering, I started fooling around with poetry about age 24, actually, and really just doing it out of the sheer love for language and just sort of just exploring what I could do with it. And then one thing led to another, and led to the inauguration, I guess.
Was the poetry about the engineering work, or did you just let yourself off tether right off the bat? And
no, you know, it's interesting because, you know, poetry writing makes us think, and until I walked into my first classroom, my first creative writing classroom, this whole idea of Cuban and American, you know, I was kind of living through it, but I wasn't really questioning it. And my very first assignment, another sort of odd foreshadowing of coincidence, was write a poem about America. And that assignment started me this whole questioning of, well, where am I from? I mean, it's sort of the questions were always there, but I never had to articulate or propose an answer, right, or think about it much. And so ever since then, the whole theme of place just started, you know, floodgates opened, and I realized what I wanted to write about, and not just wanted to, but also what it was informing me, and it was guiding me and showing me things about my own life and about the world. So
it's always been sort of a personal sort of starting point anyway?
Yeah, I think it's always, you know, it took me a while to figure that out, that I had a story. I had written a few poems before, but I thought I had to write about daffodils and things like this, you know, going back to 101 famous poems. And then it was actually that moment where you realize that the irony of art as poetry, you know, that the universal is in the details, and you have that sort of spark where you finally say, well, if you tell your story passionately enough and truthfully enough and honestly enough, there's something universal about that. And that, yeah.
I'm glad you brought up the word details, because one of the things I've noticed in our discussions with writers, poetry, prose, what have you, that these are people who notice a lot of things. They're very observant people. And it sounds like the kind of thing you had to do in your engineering jobs anyway, which gives a lot of attention to detail. Things have to get done right or buildings fall down, that sort of thing. So it sounds like that aspect of things comes naturally to you anyway.
Yeah, there's a, as I always say, I love building a poem or designing a poem as much as a bridge. You know, on the surface, people often think poetry and engineering are these completely opposite things. And they are, in a way, as far as careers, obviously. I mean, they're obviously two different career paths. But there is a link, I think, in the ways that we approach language. Language has a lot of left brain parts to it, a lot of logic. And what engineering school teaches you is really just this sort of dense logic and how to problem solve. And a poem to me in some ways is a problem. You're given almost like geometric proof. Here's this sort of mass of this incomprehensible sort of emotion or event or memory or person in your life. And the poem is sort of a proof in a way to figure out what that means.
It's like building a bridge to understanding.
Line by line, trust by trust.
Wow. Okay, good stuff to talk about with Richard Blanco, the inaugural poet. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Richard. We can take your phone calls and emails as well when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Richard Blanco. He gained national attention as the poet speaking at the second inauguration of Barack Obama last January. He's in Ashland at the invitation of Chautauqua Poets and Writers to make a presentation tonight at 7:30 at Ashland High School. You can join us here now on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk to Richard about his crafts, plural, because he's both a civil engineer and a poet. And our phone number is here in the Exchange, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. For the folks who are just joining us, you mentioned that that you actually got to the poetry through engineering. Because
right.
In civil engineering, there's a lot of writing, explaining things, making proposals, that sort of stuff. But you also talked about the very dense logic just now involved in engineering. This thing, you know, dead loads, you know, your roof has to be able to hold this much weight, that sort of stuff. You know, there's no going around it. So there must be a nice liberating sense of I can actually deal with the lack of gravity in poetry or something.
Yeah, I mean, certainly it's starting a problem that can have many different right answers, unlike in engineering. As I always say, in the purely creative part of it, it is a very right brain activity, and it's very liberating, and it's amazing where, you know, to just let go where the poem wants to go or where it wants to take you. And then the more of the sort of engineer stuff also comes in the editing process and the sort of the really rigorous sort of then pulling the poem apart and seeing, you know, how is this logic working, and then how to break the logic in interesting ways that is unexpected, which is then the other part, the right brain kicks back in, you know. So it's this sort of balance between the two.
Do you ever get to a point where you say, look, wait a minute, this doesn't have to be logic, it's a poem, it's purely creative?
There are some poems where, like, there are where I reach conclusions or endings where I have to accept that, you know, that there's something, there's an echo of something that you can't quite put any sort of neat, tight logic to it. But most of my poems, as my professor used to say, are like machines. You come in one end, like, and you're spit out the other end, and you're like, "What happened?" So but they are poems, and those are usually the ones that give me the most headache because I won't let go of that till I have enough distance from the poem. I won't let go of trying to find that one neat, wrapped up ending. So.
How long will the process take then? I mean, once you've gone through a poem and gotten the initial rough draft down, I mean, you're going to walk away for a while, then come back to it, then walk away again. I mean, how many times before you finally say, okay, that's it, hands off, no more?
All right. Well, every poem is different in a way, but I usually can get to a place where I like in a poem in about a week, not working, obviously, around the clock. And so then I put it away for a while, and then I come back to it and put it away again and come back to it and then come back to it as a book, as a collection of poems, and see how the poems are informing each other. And that helps to sort of revise and edit and think about what you're obsessed about in that collection of poems. So, but every poem is different. Some, you know, there's poems in this third book that are still from the first book that never made it in the first book. So that's over 10 years, only because I think there's a growth process. And sometimes, as I say, you know, you're not ready for the poem. You know, you have to, there's something that you need to go through before that poem can really sort of come together. And so, you know, you try to push it as far as you can, but at some point you either let it go or it's done. And when it's in print, when it's in a book, I consider it sort of done. I mean, at this point, I'm not going to revise the poem, although when I read them, I do improvise. And that's interesting because as you read them, another layer of meaning starts taking place in the poem as you read them over and over again live. The oral nature of the poem really starts coming through. And so it's like sort of, I compare it to, you know, when you buy the CD or you go see the concert, you know, how musicians improvise.
Like Bob Dylan will not do it exactly like he did in the studio, right?
Exactly. So
has anybody ever come up to you after reading and said, hey, I was reading along with you. You got off the text.
A couple times, yeah.
Really?
And I'd love to explain to them why that happens. And it's interesting. And I wouldn't put that on the page. I wouldn't like how it looks on the page. But when it comes to the reading, there's something about it that naturally happens.
Do you have a poem you'd like to read? Because here we're talking about poetry and not featuring any thus far. And I want to give our listeners a chance to get familiar with the kinds of things that you're capable of doing. I found myself musing, too, about the combination of skills you have as both civil engineer and poet. I don't know if you're aware of the fact that there's this long-standing controversy over building a new Interstate 5 bridge between Oregon and Washington, and I was thinking you could design the bridge and then do the poetry
do the
at the dedication.
Well, you know, Strauss, who was the chief structural engineer for the Golden Gate Bridge, he was a poet, and there's actually in the kiosk on the, I think, the Sausalito side of the bridge. At least when I went to visit the bridge, they have his poem that I think it's called The Mighty Task Is Done, that he wrote about the bridge, posted in one of the kiosks. So it's, I'm not the first poet engineer, I guess. Okay, I was very sad to learn that.
Darn. Yeah.
This is a poem that deals with, again, that negotiation of sort of between cultural loyalties, trying to negotiate a cultural identity, really growing up in a Cuban family household, but then also sort of being attracted to this quintessential sort of sense of America, which was developed for me actually from just watching a lot of TV and growing up in Miami. Most everybody was Cuban, so America still seemed like this other place that we were going to go to someday. So it's I contextualized a lot of what I thought America was through shows like The Brady Bunch and things like that, and just iconic things on TV. And so this is one of those negotiations which deals with something that's always been a weird thing for me, which is my name. And it's called The Name I Wanted. Not Ricardo, but Richard. Because I felt like Richard Burton, a true Anglo-Saxon in tights reciting lines from Othello. Because I wanted to be as handsome as Richard Gere in a white tuxedo. Because I had a pinky ring, just like Richard Dawson on Family Feud. Because I knew I could be just as wholesome as Richie Cunningham, just as American as my father's favorite president, Nixon. Richard, not Ricardo, not my nicknames either. El Negrito, little black boy from my skin, the color of dry tobacco when I was born. Or El Galleguito, the little Galician, because that's what Tia Noelia called anyone like me, born in Spain, not 100% Cuban. Not Rico, the name Lupe wrote on my desk, branding me as Barry Manilow's Latin lover in ruffled sleeves, dancing conga at the Copacabana, all of eighth grade. And definitely not Ricardito. Little Ricky, worse than Dick.
The Name I Wanted by Richard Blanco. And I must admit, that I'm glad you're riffing on this, because when I saw the Richard, I assumed it was Blanco and mispronounced it on Friday.
No, there's no correct It should be Blanco, but there's no sort of correct. Yeah, I get that ass all the time. Either way, Blanco or Blanco.
Richard Blanco is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He was the poet at the inauguration, the second inauguration of Barack Obama last January, and he's in Ashland to talk into before an audience tonight, welcomed by the Chautauqua Poets and Writers. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about poetry and Americanness and so much more. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. You brought so many firsts to the poem, to the podium at the inauguration. So the first, was it the first Latino poet at inauguration?
Yeah.
Okay. First immigrant poet at the inauguration. First gay poet at the inauguration.
Right.
All these things.
And first engineer.
First engineer.
That's not sexy enough for the media.
that's good, but that's another set of firsts. You got the grand slam. You got four firsts taken care of as you got to the podium. First of all, the very process of getting there. I mean, when you were contacted, was the reaction like, you must mean some other Richard Blanco?
Right. yeah, when I was contacted, I was actually driving back home to Maine, and it took me a few minutes to actually realize what they were talking about. I thought they wanted me to read a poem at the White House or something like that, and then I finally said, you mean like Robert Frost, like Maya Angelou? So I was like, oh, okay, got it. So that was it was still like pretty amazing to think about that, and I got to say, like in some ways, for about 5 seconds, I wasn't very nervous.
for about 5 seconds, you were not.
Well, as I said, I feel like I had been writing about America for so. You know, most of my books deal with what is, you know, in a way, asking what is America by asking what is my place at the table as an immigrant and whatnot. But that, again, that lasted like 5 seconds, and then I just the surprising reaction was I just was overcome with a sense of gratitude and sort of looking at my past and my parents and their emphasis on education and feeling in some grand way that this was part of their honor and sort of that there was a story that part of my story was a story that they begun, and finally it felt like this sort of watershed moment, this turning of the page where now their story was done and now mine begins. And it was a really, really weird, complex moment for me of gratitude, of excitement, of terror, all these things.
So what were you asked to bring with you? I mean, did they say write a poem for this? Or we had some poems you've already written that we like? I mean, how did that whole process work?
No, they asked me to write three original poems in 3 weeks. So, yeah, obviously there's no poet on the inaugural committee. yeah, it was three poems in 3 weeks. That's the line. And, they did prefer original work. So I got right to work the next day.
Were there any directions from the White House on content?
None whatsoever. They just offered the theme of the inauguration and some of the sort of, you know, just some of what the flavor of the inauguration. And it was on Martin Luther King Day for the first time, I think, in history. It was a 100-year dedication of the statue. And I forget my details now on top of the Capitol, that the Capitol hadn't been finished. And it was actually 100 years to that date as well. So they sort of gave me that sense of what was the groundwork and the thematics of the inauguration. But that was it. There was no, they didn't change a comma. They didn't change a word. They didn't change anything. They didn't ask me to write about anything in particular, which, I mean, spoke incredibly to me about the amount of trust that they placed in me. Even when I went up to the podium, at the inauguration, I thought, can I bring my own copy? And thinking they'd have to put it on the teleprompter. And they're like, sure, why not? So I could have gotten up there and read a Ginsberg poem for all they knew. So again, that spoke to that incredible trust of that they placed in a poet, because I really, I didn't have any relationship with the administration ever. I mean, I don't, and you know, I was kind of like a wild card in a way.
Did they give you any, I mean, they must've said, you know, it needs to be, you know, 5 minutes or something, or 10 minutes, or.
They said like 3 or 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. I took 7, I think.
Ooh.
I think.
The poem that they ended up choosing, I wrote the name down here and I can't find it.
Oh, one today, yeah.
Okay. But these are very fresh themes. I mean, it was about it included things like the rising of the Freedom Tower, The children shot dead in Sandy Hook Elementary right. School in Newtown, Connecticut. So you were working with what was around you at that moment, it sounds like.
Yeah, the Sandy Hook tragedy happened while this was actually just days after on the 14th, and I believe it was 14th. And it was really interesting because, you know, as an immigrant, there was still sort of, I think, a part of me that said, well, you're not really 100% American, like you just heard on the poem, you know, America, some other little boy on TV or some other place I haven't been yet. And so there's always sort of this little sort of void that always said, well, I'm not sure I can, you know. And then I had to ask, you know, very important questions of myself, because a poem is not just a creative endeavor, but an emotional endeavor. And that was, you know, is this your country, Richard, or Ricardo, or Ricky? Is this your home? Is this where you belong? Is this the place where you're going to choose to die? And those were serious questions that I hadn't, you know, I knew that as a poet, I couldn't honestly write a poem for a country that perhaps I didn't feel I was part of 100%. And through Sandy Hook, I realized I had an incredible emotional connection, as we all did, with everyone there, but also as a family. And it was this emotional trigger that made me understand that, yes, I am connected to this country. We all are connected, even though our stories are also different. And I remember the service where the president was at, and I think they did in three different traditions of faith. And it just made me feel like, you know, all our stories do come together at some point. And I felt part of America in a way that I hadn't felt for a long time. And then that was the emotional trigger that allowed me to sort of start really break through in the poems.
Does poetry require itself to be written sometimes? I mean, when you're feeling something as strongly as a lot of us felt about Sandy Hook, is it something, this has to go on paper, whether it is something that ends up in final poem form or not?
I mean, certainly that's the way I work. I mean, that's what keeps me addicted to poetry is that whole, you know, trying to figure out what something means. I mean, we have these raw emotions, these complex emotions, these memories that we're not sure, we've not gone back over and realized what they mean in our lives. And certainly that's what brings me to the page. So in some ways it's a very, as I always like to say, poetry, or I think many arts, are in some ways a very selfish endeavor. They're this wanting to know about myself and my place in the world. And but through the magic of art, I think that poem becomes a mirror as well. So it's, if I understand something about the human condition through my experience, then hopefully someone that reads the poem it'll be mirrored in someone who reads the poem and will understand some context about their lives. But yeah, certainly that's what keeps me addicted to poetry, and keeps me on my toes, so to speak, always questioning life, always questioning what things mean, current, past events, people in my life, you know, and otherwise, I know no other approach to poetry. I think that's the big thrill.
Well, likewise, Boston Strong, about Boston after the bombing. Did that, in a sense, demand to be written?
Yes, it was something that, of course, it was closer to home to me in Maine, and also what happened in that context was a little bit different too, because after the inauguration, I've been asked to write poems, sort of commissioned like a sculptor or a portrait painter or whatnot. So that was part of, you know, I'd been wanting to write something, and then all this happened with the One Fund, which is the organization that's created to benefit the survivors, the victims, and whatnot. And yeah, I mean, it was a very slippery poem to write because I'm not a Bostonian and I'm not from Boston, so it was something I had to sort of have a little more distance and respect, because I didn't want to pretend to feel exactly what West Bostonians felt. So it was more a poem of honor and respect and of healing that I was offering as a close observer versus someone that was involved in the actual events. So
when people start commissioning poems, I mean, you have to be fairly choosy in the commissions that you'll accept based on things like the knowledge of the community and how much you can get yourself into the poem that they're asking for.
Yeah. Part of it has to do with, one thing is, like, there has to be still an emotional core that I need to feel something about, whether it's the values of the organization or what happened in the event or something that I feel that I can get to close to emotionally. And what happened is that the process of writing the inaugural poems were a great sort of creative, how can I say it? It was a very, it broke new creative ground for me in thinking about what a poem could do and how to engage a poem and how to write a poem in a slightly different way than I had been used to. So it's not just a completely autobiographical piece, but finding that one emotional core that's that you can connect with and sort of trying to figure that out and then add to that your own, impart into that your own feelings about what this organization or what this event meant or what this occasion meant. So
Richard Blanco is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He was the inaugural poet last year at the second inauguration of Barack Obama in Ashland Tonight, brought here by Chautauqua Poets and Writers. We'll come back and talk more with him, and if you'd like to join us by phone or email, you can do that as well. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Richard Blanco, part poet, part engineer, part Cuban, part American, part Spanish. He brought a lot of firsts with him to the podium when he was the poet at the inauguration, the second inauguration of Barack Obama in January of 2013. He'll be in Ashland tonight, is in Ashland now, but he'll be talking before an audience at Ashland High School, brought to town by Chautauqua Poets and Writers. You can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange now at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. We have an email here from Louise in Ashland. She wants to know, do you write any poems in Spanish?
I always try to include a couple poems in Spanish in each collection. And usually it's when I go to Cuba or a Spanish-speaking country where I start thinking 100% in Spanish and I get inspired, obviously, by landscapes and people in another language. And I try to include one in, or two in every poem. But I am an American poet, and that is my language, and that's certainly the stronger of the two. And I was educated in English. So certainly what I like to do is translate my own work, and that's always a really interesting and neat process. So in the books, you'll read the poems, and it'll appear like a literal translation. But what I do is actually I start with this poem in Spanish and start translating line by line, and changing it in the English if it, the translation doesn't work, like working with the imagery or the syntax, and then reverse translating it in this, in whatever I change back to the Spanish and seeing how it works in Spanish. And if it doesn't work in Spanish, I change it to Spanish and translate it a second time into English. So the poem really is co-created, or they're actually mirrors of each other. They start happening at the same time, and that's kind of the way the bilingual mind works. We code switch all the time, so when we find something that we can't express in one language, we think about it in another, and vice versa. So it's only I know that, but when you see it on the page, it looks like a little translation, but really the poems are married.
Are there times when you're working on a poem in English and you think, boy, there's just no real music to the way I would have to say this in English. But boy, in Spanish, the words are wonderful. All those vowel sounds.
No, because I think most of it has to do with experience and how I experience the moment, whether I experience it in English or Spanish. And again, that usually happens when I'm in Cuba or a Spanish-speaking country, where I'm actually experiencing things in that other language and really starting to think in that other language. But I'm not, you know, wouldn't want to be ever put in the same bin as Neruda. I'm not a Latin American poet. I mean, I do follow the traditions of American poetry, but I think, you know, it's, what I bring to the table is an echo of what that being bicultural means. So, of course, in the Spanish, I also pepper a lot of the poems with Spanish, and those are words that I don't hear in English, and I can't say aunt in English. Like this, that word has absolutely no emotional depth to me. So
not
it has
like
to
tia.
Be dia or mm-hmm. deal or things like that. So those are words that I refuse to translate in some ways, but in context, it's all very clear. So,
do you have another poem you'd like to read?
Let's see. What are you in the mood for? think about something might be a little shorter. Something that we can work with here.
We got time. I mean, we got about 10, 12 minutes here, so don't feel like you're don't feel like the inauguration gun is at your head. 5 minutes, no more.
Is it something a little more, maybe a slightly a little more abstract, about the topic of writing, and or this poem is in some ways an ars poetica. It's a poem about poetry in some ways. It's called "Burning in the Rain," and anybody who's a poet out there or a writer has probably gone through this scenario here in the poem. Someday, compassion would demand I set myself free of my desire to recreate my father, indulge in my mother's losses, strangle lovers with words, forcing them to confess for me and take the blame. Today was that day. I tossed them sheet by sheet on the patio and gathered them into a pyre. I wanted to let them go in a blaze. Tiny white dwarfs imploding beside the azaleas and ficus bushes. Let them crackle, burst like winged seeds. Let them smolder into gossamer embers, 1,000,000 gray butterflies in the wind. Today was that day, but it rained, kept raining. Instead of fire, water, drops knocking on doors, wetting windows into mirrors reflecting me in the oaks. The garden walls and stones swelling into ghostlier shades of themselves. The wind chimes giggling in the storm. A coffee cup left overflowing with rain. Instead of burning, my pages turned into water lilies, floating over puddles. Then tiny white cliffs as the sun set. Finally drying all night under the moon. Into papier-mâché souvenirs, the day, the rain, will not let their lives burn.
Burning in the Rain from Richard Blanco. Again, he'll be in Ashlands High School tonight. Welcomed by Chautauqua Poets and Writers, was at the inauguration last year. When were you first published? I mean, you'd been an engineer for a couple of years then, it sounds like, by the time you first got any poetry published.
Yeah, the first book was in 1998. Yeah, it was through a first book contest at the University of Pittsburgh, which is kind of the typical route for a first book of poetry. So, yeah, it must have been about 26, I think, 27.
Up to that point, had you entertained any thoughts of making poetry the full-time occupation, or had you always just thought, this will be my sidelight?
Yeah, that's not really something you can entertain very much in poetry. I mean, I did end up, obviously, I started exploring through community college classes and eventually got more serious, but always I had no expectation. And I sometimes wonder if that's not sort of part of this, a secret to life is to not expect anything, but you can't fake that either. You can't fake not having expectations. So I just was happy to be doing something that I loved, working on something creative that I think I had been, kept from all my life. And, wherever this happens, is everything's icing on the cake. It was afterwards, after I got the first book published, and then I felt like suddenly now I'm a poet. And I went to teach it in Connecticut and whatnot. That's when the pressure started more to set in more, that sense of like, now this is a career and a vocation. And, and I got really left-brained about it. And I think the writing slowed down and got more difficult because I was approaching it with more apprehension and fear and expectation.
You said kept from it. I mean, like you were kept from creative pursuits. I mean, your parents are fairly serious about, like, you need to have some skill that you can make a decent living at, which is why you got the civil engineering degree, correct?
Right.
But how did they feel about, I mean, they were pretty big on education from it sounds like, big on reading, all that sort of thing.
Yeah, but you got to understand there's also a cultural divide as well. So, it's very complex, and these are pieces of yourself that you can't really separate. They all happen at the same time. So one aspect was my homophobic grandmother, who was constantly on my case. And so the idea of also having a career in the arts was squelched by her sort of vigilance and you know, would not accept anything other than a manly career. So that influenced me. The other thing is just sort of, again, the socioeconomic status that we had. You know, there was my parents, the idea of a life in the arts was just not anything I knew could be possible. And then there's a cultural divide as well, because even if we were sitting around the table talking about art, it wouldn't be about Picasso and Robert Frost. It would be about Wilfredo Lam and Nicolas Guillén, Jose Martí, and another whole set of a tradition of art. So all these three things sort of played into certain decisions. And, you know, honestly, you know, double-edged sword, but I was good at math, so it was an option. I mean, clearly we know some children will not grow up to be engineers, and we clearly know that some children will not grow up to be artists, and so I had options in that sense too, but all these other factors played into that first initial decision to study engineering.
You'd mentioned the homophobic grandmother a fair amount in your work, but how did your parents deal with your sexuality?
Well, my dad had passed away already when I had come out, so I didn't have to deal with that. I think it's very typical. I mean, there's an initial sort of shock, but a certain acceptance at that level. But also, you know, parents, I think, need to go through their own coming out process, and that took a few years. And now everything is pretty much peachy king. but it took work. It took a lot of emotional work on both our behalfs to be able to. I'm speaking mostly about my mother, who was. My grandmother had passed away as well. So it was the one, you know, close living relative beside my brother that I had to have that conversation with.
The process of poetry, you'd mentioned how things had changed when it went from being something as a side pursuit to your engineering career, and it became the central part of your career then. How often do you write, and for how long, and what's your process like? Do you lock yourself in a room for an hour a day and make sure you get out two pages or something? I've heard prose writers talk about that sort of thing.
Yeah, prose writers have it different, though.
Yeah, they do.
Two things have happened. One is I'm a vampire writer. I guess from having a full-time job all day and sort of write. So I can't get out of that habit of writing until like 2 or 3 or 4 in the morning. So that's one part of it. The other part of it is that I write in spurts. I'm not one of those people that sits down every day physically to write. And there is this adage in amongst creative writing folks and classes of writers write every day, I feel like we need to qualify that. Writing isn't just sitting down and writing. Writing is paying attention to the world every day in some way as a writer. And, you know, you can sit down in front of the screen for 2 hours and get nothing, and really you're better served by sometimes going to take a walk in the park. And I know that's happened to me, and the minute I'm in the park for 3 seconds and, you know, that line comes that I was waiting for 2 hours staring at the screen. So that there's that element. We have to get our butts in the seat. That's certainly true. It's not an excuse to not do that. But that writing is not just that. Writing is a way of thinking and a way of life, and it's not just the writing that makes you a writer.
I've noticed a fair number of writers, prose and poetry, who they take notes on things. You know, they've either got little bits of paper in their pocket all the time, or they've got the iPad or whatever. Is there some place where you keep things, or is it all stored in your head until the next time you get to a keyboard?
I try to keep in the habit of writing, of keeping a little journal, and I've done it from time to time. Really, I got to burn them before I die, because it's just really horrible. Most cliche stuff, but just to try and record that one little moment where you're like, oh my God, this is something I need to remember. But I do ferment a lot, and I think I've been blessed with a great memory. And I think I ferment a lot of lines and images, and if they keep on obsessing me and they keep on fermenting, at one point they come out, and I think it's just my mind is processing where that little moment fits in a poem. And so they'll be with me for years, and then they'll spit out somewhere in the most surprising places. But I do try to keep a habit of at least jotting those little initial, and then I go back to them, and I can re-inhabit that space and think a little bit more about what poem that might be for.
I can almost see the smile of recognition, though, as you're working on a poem. It's like, oh, there's that line I stored a couple of years ago.
Or sometimes I've gone back to the journal and realized that I had written poems that incorporate all these things without going back to these specific moments. Rather, you know, old journals, I'm like, oh, yeah, I wrote about that, and I wrote about that, and I wrote about that.
So I was surprised to see that you're working with Dave Pilkey on a project.
Yeah.
Dave Pilkey of Captain Underpants fame.
Yeah.
What's that project about?
They're doing a children's book, which is I say they because it's the inaugural poem, so it's the easiest book I ever wrote. But it's very exciting. It's a whole different world that publishing is a whole subculture of publishing. The children's books are something is a whole brand new world to me, and I haven't met Dave, but we've been speaking through email and whatnot, and it's been an incredibly interesting process to see his creative process and the things that he's coming up with in terms of the images and you know, adding who's the narrator and all these. So I'm very excited to see what's going to happen. Of course, it takes forever. I didn't realize how long children's books take. They actually paint every single page.
Oh, because all the detail, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it'll be out in 2016, I think, some point.
And you have a memoir coming out that you're working on, too. Is that right?
Yes. It's a full-length memoir from Echo Press. Echo, an imprint of HarperCollins. And that luckily was something that I had actually written most of before all this inauguration jazz hit. So it has nothing to do with being an inaugural poet or anything like that. It's up to age 16, and it's sort of what we were talking about earlier, that triangulation between, you know, where does culture, homophobia, and socioeconomic things, how all those things collide and intersect to make a human being. And so it's sort of that kind of coming of age, coming of cultural age, coming of out age story, all sort of woven together.
All kinds of stuff. Richard Blanco was the inaugural poet at last year's inauguration of Barack Obama and will be in Ashland tonight. Welcome by Chautauqua Poets and Writers to Ashland High School at 7:30. Thank you so much for joining us in The Exchange.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
Great to have you. Tomorrow on The Exchange, we'll talk to the folks at the Oregon Chocolate Festival. We'll get a warning about e-cigarettes starting fires, and then we'll talk about writing again with Molly Tinsley and Jim Sulzer. All tomorrow on The Jefferson Exchange. Our producer and today's engineer, Charlotte Duren. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great day.